Today, more cracks below the surface. The DFA Daily to the 5th of February 2021. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. The RBA Governor gave evidence to the House of Representatives Standing Committee on Economics and rehearsed the speech he gave earlier in the week, and it also reflects the statement on monetary policy which was released today. This includes a comment on the housing market, which they say they're watching closely. Now, they said, there are many moving parts at present. Record low interest rates, a shift in preferences towards houses and regional locations, large government incentives for first home buyers, the slowest population growth in a century, very high rates of house building, and a decline in apartment rents in Sydney and Melbourne. And they said, in the face of all these moving parts, the housing market has been more resilient than expected. And this has been helpful in terms of the overall economy. The past year would have been even more complicated if there had been large and widespread falls in housing prices. And they went on to say housing prices are now rising across most of the country, but even so, the National Housing Price Index is only around the level reached 4 years ago. And the RBA went on to say that, as they had previously discussed, the RBA does not, and indeed should not, target housing prices. Instead, their focus is on the lending that is used to purchase houses. We want to see lending standards remaining strong, they said. At present, there are few signs of a deterioration in these standards, but if that were to change, then you might expect that they would be discussing responses at the Council of Financial Regulators, as we did a few years ago. And the Council of Financial Regulators, of course, includes the Reserve Bank, ASIC, APRA, and a few hangers-on. I guess the point to make there, though, is that this is an interesting comment insofar that the model that was published some little time ago by Peter Tulip, modelling a significant price rise if interest rates dropped by 100 basis points, had no connection at all to lending. So it's interesting that the Reserve Bank here is actually making an obvious connection. It's one that I keep talking about. As credit grows, so does home prices. And if credit decreases, that also translates to lower home prices. So we should watch credit growth as an early indicator of what may be happening to home prices. But it is worth reflecting on this, that values are still lower than in 2017, and that's before inflation, as illustrated by both the ABS index and even the CoreLogic index. Yes, folks, prices are lower than they were in 2017. Funny how that's not being reported in the mainstream media. Now, elsewhere, the retail sales volumes rose 2.5% in the December quarter, seasonally adjusted, according to the ABS retail trade figures. And that follows the 6.5% rise in the September quarter. The quarterly rise was driven by Victoria, up 12.8%, as volumes recovered following COVID-19 restrictions from August to October. Without the Victorian rise, seasonally adjusted volumes would have fallen in the December quarter. Now, this is an important warning. Retail is not as strong as, again, being reported in the mainstream. At a national level, clothing, footwear and personal accessory retailing, which were 18.1%, and cafes, restaurants and takeaway foods at 10.4% led the rises in seasonally adjusted terms. Department stores at 12% and other retailing at 2.7% also rose, but food retailing fell down 2.6% and household goods retailing fell 0.6%. And that's a quarter-on-quarter fall in season-adjusted volume terms. And if you look in more detail at the Australian retail turnover in December, it fell 4.1% seasonally adjusted. That updates the preliminary result of down 4.2%, and that follows a rise of 7.1% in November. In Victoria, there was a fall of 6.8%. That, of course, follows the strong trade in November. New South Wales was down 4.9%, and it also fell as the Northern Beaches cluster impacted spending in the lead up to Christmas. Queensland was down 1.8%. Western Australia was down 2%. Tasmania was down 4.6%. South Australia was down 0.7%. And the Australian Capital Territory down 1.6%. Now, despite the falls in annual terms, retail turnover remains at elevated levels, 9.6%. above the levels of December 2019. So following the large rise in November, five of the six industries fell in December, led by household goods retailing down 8.3%, clothing, footwear and personal accessory retailing down 9.4%, department stores down 12.5%, food retailing down 1.7%, and other retailing down 4.4%. Cafes, restaurants and takeaway food services were 3.2% higher, and that was the only industry to rise in December, and perhaps that's linked to more people going out to celebrate Christmas and the New Year. And online sales made up 9.1% of total retail sales in December, compared with 6.6% a year before. And just remember that the trend series has been suspended from February 2020, due to the virus and the associated changes that will impact the original and season-adjusted series. Now let's look at home ownership, which stays a pipe dream for many. Despite rising numbers of new home loans amid the COVID-19 economic recovery, the outlook for housing affordability remains bleak. And more of us will be renting long-term, according to research from the University of Melbourne, as published in their Pursuit series. In 2020, the global economic landscape was shaken by the COVID-19 pandemic. Here in Australia, borders closed to international visitors, social distancing measures were invoked, and working from home became the norm. But despite the dramatic impact of COVID-19, there's been a surge in the number of Australians realising the great Australian dream of home ownership. With record low interest rates, massive fiscal stimulus from governments and explicit measures targeted at supporting the construction sector, namely the Home Builder Scheme, the housing market in 2020 defied expectations of a large downturn. In July 2020, the number of new home loans provided to first home buyers exceeded 10,000 for the first time in 10 years. And this increase has continued unabated, with new home loans to first home buyers exceeding 14,000 in November, excluding loan refinancing. Over 35% of new owner-occupied loan commitments are for first home buyers. Now, recent survey data suggests this trend is likely to continue in the short term, but longer term, however, the research suggests that affordability issues that are locking people out of the market will continue. Back in April 2020, amid the onset of the pandemic, the market was anticipating a sharp drop in property prices. The Melbourne Institute's Time to Buy a Dwelling Index, which measures consumer sentiment towards purchasing dwellings, fell to 82.1. An index value of 100 represents the points at which optimists exactly offset pessimists, with values below 100 indicating that pessimists outweigh optimists. At the time, over 30% of consumers expected house prices to fall by up to 10% over the next 12 months. But by December, the time to buy a dwelling index had dramatically recovered to pre-COVID levels, with only 8% of consumers expecting prices to fall by up to 10%. Currently, over 40% of consumers now expect prices to increase by up to 10% over the next 12 months. The pace of house price appreciation has been inordinately sharp over the past few years, outpacing income growth and making housing less affordable, especially for lower to moderate income households. The deterioration in housing affordability is highlighted in data compiled by the OECD, showing a sharp increase in Australian house price to income and house price to rent ratios, particularly over the last 20 years. The house price to rent ratio is a measure of the strength of the housing market relative to rental markets. The higher the ratio, the more house prices are outpacing rents. In the 1970s and 80s, the OECD price-to-income ratio averaged around 76 for Australia. Rising to an average of 85 during the 1990s, the ratio surpassed 100 for the first time in 2002. And over the past 5 years, it's averaged nearly 140. Unsurprisingly, given the increasing number of people being priced out of housing, since the mid-1990s, the proportion of renters has risen from below 20% in New South Wales and Victoria to approximately 30%. This increase in the supply of rental properties has been largely driven by ordinary households, with one in five Australian households owning more than one property and about 5% of households owning four or more properties. Notwithstanding the increase in first home ownership and home buyer sentiment that we've seen since 2020, it's unlikely that these broader trends, particularly the rising proportion of renters, will change. The improved housing market sentiment is far from uniform across different demographic groups. It is stronger among those who already own a house that they can therefore sell or borrow against to easily buy again, but more muted among renters lacking these advantages. Broken down by age, household sentiment is strongest for older Australians, a group that is more likely to own their home, and weakest for Australians aged 18 to 34, who are more likely to be renting than their older counterparts. Previous research had highlighted the importance of monetary policy and interest rates on house prices and the potential for the housing market to overshoot on prices. Although interest rates should naturally lead to higher asset prices because buyers have access to cheaper credit, their work suggests that households can overreact to low interest rates, leading to greater than expected house price rises, particularly in larger capital cities. Low interest rates are therefore more likely to result in two-speed housing markets. And recent research has also provided evidence that house prices in more expensive areas are often more sensitive to changes in interest rates, with lower interest rates potentially resulting in greater housing wealth inequality. And the research therefore suggests that expectations of a significant downward correction in house prices that will favour lower income first home buyers is unlikely to be realised. And importantly, the presence of record low interest rates coupled with Reserve Bank's guidance for a prolonged period of low interest rates is likely to support housing prices in the short to medium term, notwithstanding lower population growth going forward. This suggests that existing home ownership trends are likely to continue to persist, with large numbers of younger households continuing to rent rather than having the ability to purchase their own homes. And in this environment, it's vital that policies support renters and facilitate an environment of sustainable long-term renting, particularly with regards to normalising longer-term rental agreements. The reality is that many more Australians will be long-term renters, and policy making needs to adapt accordingly. And there was another article in the same series entitled "Too Many Eggs in the Property Wealth Basket." Australia's over-reliance on property for wealth generation will weigh on the economy if house prices drop, but falling small business ownership looms as a bigger problem, by Andrew Tronson from the University of Melbourne. extended house price falls as the COVID-induced economic downturn bites would dampen economic growth given Australia's heavy reliance on property markets for wealth generation. But failing rates of business ownership in the country may be a bigger threat to growth, they said. The latest household income and labour dynamics in Australia, the HILDA survey, of 17,000 Australians shows that COVID-19 has hit at a time when net household wealth, that's the value of assets less any debt owed, had been growing strongly. Since 2014, median household wealth rose more than 17% to around $504,000 on average in 2018, measured in 2018 dollars. That compares with a 5% fall in median wealth between 2006 and 2014, following the end of the mining boom and the onset of the global financial crisis. But about half of average Australian household assets are held in the value of the home, accounting for an average of $509,000 out of total average household assets of around $1.1 million US dollars. And that's despite one-third of householders not being homeowners. On average, a further $161,000 is held in investment property and holiday homes. About 21% of Australian households have an investment property and or a holiday home. And in contrast, the proportion of households owning a business has dropped from 13% in 2006 right down to less than 10% in 2018. And the average value of these businesses has shrunk from $65,000 to $44,000. We seem to have an over-reliance on property when it comes to pursuing wealth in Australia. And that isn't ideal for the economy, says HILDA survey leader Professor Roger Wilkins from the University of Melbourne. He said that while a looming fall in house prices in the wake of COVID-19 would in the short term be a drag on the economy, given how important housing is to the wealth of Australians, he says lower house prices would actually be a positive in the longer term. A step down in house prices to a low level would be in the interests of the broader community, as it would broaden home ownership, especially for younger Australians who have been shut out by high prices, he said. It would also be good if more of the community could find other ways to increase their wealth rather than focusing on property. The idea of creating and building a business idea is pretty alien to Australians' investment culture, and that isn't good for generating economic growth. Ideally, you want people to feel that they can get ahead by doing something productive, like producing and innovating products and services that people want, but can increase economic output. But Professor Wilkins says he's concerned that the pandemic downturn will hurt small businesses especially hard. Small businesses tend to be disproportionately in sectors like hospitality, recreation, and the arts that have been so cruelly hard hit by the downturn and the social restrictions aimed at controlling COVID-19. And I will just make the point that this is research up to 2018. Of course, the numbers have become significantly worse since then on so many fronts. Now, over at AAP, they reported that more universities warn that more jobs will be lost. The minister responsible for Australia's education sector doesn't believe universities have lost more than 17,000 jobs in the wake of the coronavirus pandemic. Alan Tudge said he was surprised at the figures put forward by Universities Australia, as he thought it was around 5,000 jobs. Still very significant, he said, on Sky on Wednesday. Universities Australia has warned more job losses are on the cards because of the ongoing economic impact of the coronavirus pandemic. The sector's peak body estimates that about $1.8 billion in operating revenue was lost in 2020 compared with the year before. Compared with the university's pre-pandemic budgeted revenue for 2020, the losses actually amount to more than $3 billion. The sector is preparing to lose another $2 billion this year, largely due to international students still unable to travel to Australia. Now, Mr. Tudge says the sector is yet to ask him for more funding. and he plans to keep a close eye on the situation, but brushed over the sector's revenue concerns. We are concerned if there are job losses, but we are also having to understand that they've operated surpluses for many years before this. The sector was effectively excluded from the government's JobKeeper wage subsidy programme, despite warnings the decision would lead to huge job losses. Labour's education spokeswoman, Tanya Plibersek, says the sector should not have been excluded from JobKeeper, pointing to the pivotal role they've played in Australia's virus response. It's our universities that we've turned to during the COVID-19 pandemic to ask them to look at vaccines, look at treatments, to look at the way the disease spreads in our community, she told reporters in Canberra. It's universities that we're turning to train the doctors, the nurses, the epidemiologists, as well as the engineers, the computer programmers, that we're going to need coming out of the recession. And Universities Australia boss Catriona Jackson has thanked the federal government for supporting research funding with $1 billion and said the peak body will continue to push for more support. The hit from the pandemic will be felt by universities for many years ahead, of course. If an international student doesn't enrol in 2020, the loss will be felt for what would have been their entire 3 or 4 years at university, Ms. Jackson said. The loss of any and every one of these staff is personally devastating, bad for the university community and for Australia's knowledge reservoir. The nation's international borders were closed last March and is expected to remain shut for most of this year. Mr. Tudge said South Australia was close to finalising a proposal on how to bring international students to the state without taking up any limited spots in hotel quarantine. Other states have been encouraged to suggest plans of their own. But it must be said that the university sector, in my mind, is right up against it because of many years of bad planning, bad management, and bad execution, and frankly an over-reliance on Chinese students. Over in the US, the US jobless claims fell to the lowest level since the end of November. Applications for US state unemployment benefits fell last week to the lowest level since the end of November, a sign that job cuts are starting to slow as COVID-19 infections ebb. Initial jobless claims in regular state programs decreased by 33,000 to 779,000 in the week ended January the 30th. That's the third straight week of decline, according to Labour Department data. On an unadjusted basis, applications dropped to 816,247. Continuous claims, an approximation of the number of Americans filing for multiple weeks of state benefits, decreased to 4.59 million in the week ended January the 23rd. And economists in a Bloomberg survey forecast 830,000 initial claims and a 4.7 million continuing claims. The figures, while still elevated, indicate that layoffs related to the pandemic are starting to ebb after jobless claims picked up in December and early January. In the coming months, as more Americans get inoculated and virus cases fall, economic activity is poised to resume and job cuts may decline further. Policymakers are starting to lift some of the most stringent business restrictions, which should also help to stabilise the labour market. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo said indoor dining can reopen in New York City on February the 14th, and California Governor Gavin Newsom lifted the state's stay-at-home order on January the 25th. The S&P 500 rose for the fourth day in a row, and the yield on the 10-year Treasury note increased to its highest since mid-March. Some economists, including those at Goldman Sachs, raised their forecasts for January payrolls following the claims report and other recent labour market data. And the jobless claims data precede Friday's monthly jobs report, which is forecast to show the economy added around 100,000 jobs last month after a 140,000 decline in December. Data from ADP Research Institute on Wednesday showed company payrolls increased by 174,000 in January. And on Tuesday, Senate Democrats put President Joe Biden's $1.9 trillion stimulus plan on a fast track to passage, increasing the likelihood it eventually passes on a party line vote. The bill text has not been drafted yet, but Biden's proposal includes an extension of expiring federal unemployment programs through to September and an increase in supplemental benefits from $300 to $400 a week. And separate data on Thursday showed productivity, or output per hour, fell in the final 3 months of 2020 by the most since 1981. The decline was a result of a larger jump in hours worked than in output, as more Americans headed back to work. And states reporting the largest declines in initial claims included Illinois, which showed more than 55,000 decreased. Among others, Texas and Kansas had declines that exceeded 8,000. And initial claims in California surged by more than 46,000. Initial claims for pandemic unemployment assistance for self-employed and gig workers fell by 54,678 to 348,912 last week on an unadjusted basis. The program has been subject to widespread fraud, with California estimating that 95% of the state's fraudulent payments were for PUA claims. And in the week ended January the 16th, there were 3.6 million continuing claims from pandemic emergency unemployment compensation, which provides extended jobless benefits for those who have exhausted their regular state benefits. And finally, as AAP reported, UK banks need at least 6 months to prepare for any cut in interest rates below zero, the Bank of England has said, as it kept its stimulus programme on hold ahead of what it hopes will be an economic recovery later this year. The central bank published on Thursday the results of its review of how prepared lenders such as HSBC, Lloyds and Barclays are for any move to implement negative interest rates in the UK for the first time. The Prudential Regulation Authority's engagement with regulated firms have indicated that implementation of a negative bank rate over a shorter time frame than 6 months would attract increased operational risks, the Bank of England said in a statement. The pound jumped by more than half a US cent against the US dollar. And the British government bond yield jumped by around 3 basis points as investors scaled back their bets that the Bank of England will implement negative rates anytime soon. The Bank of England actually said it did not want to send a signal that it intended to set a negative rate, but it would be appropriate to start the preparations to provide the capability to do so if necessary in the future. And the Bank of England regulators should start getting banks ready to implement negative rates at any point from 6 months' time, it said. And the Bank of England said it was also working on developing a new message for investors and businesses about when it might start to remove the huge stimulus which is currently in place for the UK's economy. The committee agreed to ask bank staff to commence work to reconsider the previous guidance on the appropriate strategy for tightening monetary policy, should that be required in the future, it said. Of course, the bank maintained its bank rate of 0.1% and left the size of its total asset purchases at £895 billion, which is 1.6 trillion Australian dollars. The Bank of England said the UK economy would probably shrink by 4% in the first 3 months of 2021, but it was expected to recover rapidly towards pre-COVID levels over 2021. And the central bank lowered its forecast for British economic growth for this year as a whole to 5% from its November forecast of 7.25%, but it raised its forecast for the growth rate in 2022 to 7.25% from 6.25%. And it stuck to its previous forecast that the country's economy would return to its size at the end of 2019 before the pandemic struck by the first quarter of 2022. So standing back, this just continues to show that there are more issues here and more cracks could certainly appear. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.